Welcome to The Right to Reason. I'm Robert Stanley, and today you're going to be hearing from Amir Aziz, writer for The Huffington Post and a very well-studied Muslim.
Hey, this is Amir Aziz. I'm with the Muslim Writers Guild of America and the Ahmadiyya Muslim community, and you have The Right to Reason.
I'm going to ask him why there is so much violence and rape in the Quran. And he's going to talk about Trump's Muslim ban, the history of the Crusade, Sam Harris, and the infallibility of the Quran. All that happens right now.
And let me assure you that we are going to take our fight for economic justice, for social justice, for environmental sanity, for a world of peace.
Support The Right to Reason at patreon.com/right.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are a way for the cosmos to know itself.
Like our page on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Right to Reason 1. Subscribe to us on YouTube.
And I think it should be religion treated with ridicule and hatred and contempt. And I claim that right.
Learn more about the broadcast at therighttoreason.com.
Amir Aziz is a speaker, writer, and editor with the Muslim Writers Guild of America, a body of writers combating media caricatures of Islam. He writes opinion editorials in newspapers in the USA and abroad, and blogs with the Huffington Post, Patheost, On Faith and Belief Net, mostly on Islam and religion. That's what we're going to talk to him about today. He's a member of the Ahmadiyya Muslim Community, a 19th century Messianic revivalist movement founded by Mirza Ghulam Ahmad, who Ahmadiyya Muslims believe was the Messiah foretold by Muhammad and Jesus. That's interesting. The movement spans 200 plus countries with membership in the tens of millions. I did not know that. Amir, happy to have you.
Hey, happy to be here. Thanks for having me on the show.
So cool to have a HuffPo writer, man. I love your stuff. I've been reading a lot of it, and it's great writing. I want to talk to you about your faith and the details of it. But before we get there, I kind of want to pick your brain about just the term itself. Trump's America drives me nuts. But being a Muslim in Trump's America, it's not Trump's America. With the Muslim ban and his attack, and it's not just an attack on ISIS, you know, like his attack is on people themselves and actual citizens of a significant demographic of America. I always like the idea of there's nothing wrong with disrespecting someone's beliefs. Yeah, it's not polite, it's not comfortable, but that's also how we discuss things in the marketplace of ideas, right? You could say, Robert, I don't respect your atheism. And I would go, okay, you know, I understand that. I could say, well, Amir, I don't respect your Islamic faith. And you say, but yeah, of course, you're not a Muslim. I know you wouldn't necessarily respect my faith, but I'm not going to disrespect you as a person. And I feel like that's kind of the story of what's happening in America right now is Trump and a lot of the right-wing people, they are disrespecting a people.
We put out a statement a while ago, and these people are going crazy. I kissed her and she kissed me. They won't report it, bro. Shall I read you the statement? Donald J. Trump is calling for, now listen, you got to listen to this one because this is pretty heavy stuff and it's common sense and we have to do it. Remember the poll numbers, 25%, 51%, remember the poll numbers. Okay, so remember this, so listen. Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on. We have no choice. We have no choice.
Tell me quick, ain't love a kick in the head.
You know, it's really interesting that with Trump, you know, starting with his campaign, I think that he brought in a lot of amplification and accentuation of certain rhetorics and sentiments and dispositions that were already out there. And he played those cards during his campaign and he kind of racketed up the rhetoric, you know, the anti-Muslim rhetoric, but it had already been there. you know, with the backdrop of extremism, terrorism, you can call it, ISIS, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, there's a certain take that people have in this country, especially Christians. Kind of accentuate that with evangelical Christians, which is a core base that Trump played off. So I think he knew definitely which buttons to push, and which strings to play off. And it's something that had already been there. And we've since you know, with my introduction, you know, I'm part of a group that combats or tries to respond to these media. Media narratives about Muslims, about the fundamental and foundational beliefs of Muslims, and about our holy books and our foundational texts. And people rightly have these questions, is that, you know, what is behind all this extremism? You know, what is motivating people from that part of the world or from that particular ideology to commit these kinds of acts? And, you know, a part of it is political. It's got to do with geopolitical, modern history in terms of what's been going on in the Middle East. And there's a lot of oppressive regimes out there, and they're kind of supported by the Western political establishment, so to speak. And there's a certain reaction that comes out of that. And there's a whole thing with Israel and what came out of the First World War, especially. But kind of setting that aside, setting the politics of it aside, it's just... from a religious perspective, given the extremism that's been coming out of, you know, that we've been seeing, some people have come out and said that there's a real problem with, you know, Islamic theology, with Islamic philosophy. And certain people have pushed that narrative in the media. Bill Maher, for example, is certainly, you know, one personality that's been pretty active in that area.
The other thing we want to talk about, of course, is that you and I have been trying to make the case, I think, I have anyway, that liberals need to stand up for liberal principles. This is what I said on last week's show. Obviously, I got a lot of hate for it. But all I'm saying is that liberal principles like freedom of speech, freedom to practice any religion you want without fear of violence, freedom to leave a religion, equality for women, equality for minorities, including homosexuals. These are liberal principles that liberals applaud for. But then when you say in the Muslim world, this is what's lacking, then they get upset.
Yeah, yeah. Well, liberals have really failed on the topic of theocracy. They'll criticize white theocracy. They'll criticize Christians. They'll still get agitated over the abortion clinic bombing that happened in 1984. But when you want to talk about the treatment of women and homosexuals and free thinkers and public intellectuals in the Muslim world, I would argue that liberals have failed us. And the crucial point of confusion... thank you.
Thank God you're here.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the crucial point of confusion is that we have been sold this meme of Islamophobia, where every criticism of the doctrine of Islam gets conflated with bigotry toward Muslims as people.
Right.
And that is it's intellectually ridiculous. Even it gets
so hold on, are you the person who understands the officially codified doctrine of Islam? You're the interpreter of that?
I'm actually well-educated on this topic.
I'm asking you. You're saying that Islamophobia is not a real thing. That if you're critical of something...
It's not a real thing when we do it.
Right.
Isn't. I'm not denying that certain people are bigoted against Muslims as people. That's a problem.
Big of you.
But why are you so hostile about this?
It's gross. It's racist.
It's like saying you're a shifty Jew. You're not listening we are saying.
You guys are saying, if you want to be liberals, believe in liberal principles, like freedom of speech, we are endowed by our forefathers with an inalienable right. All men are created equal.
Ben, we have to be able to criticize bad ideas.
And of course we do.
Islam,
no liberal doesn't want to criticize bad ideas.
But Islam is the mother load of bad ideas.
Jesus.
So we have
that's just a fact.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, innaka antal alimul hakim.
Sam Harris, who, you know, I don't know if I should say he's from your neck of the woods, but maybe somewhere around there, or maybe a little distant from where you are.
Yeah. I would agree with him on most things he says. I heard a discussion with him, with Dan Carlin, guy that does hardcore history, and they were going back and forth about the issues with Islam and modern day, you know, ISIS and things like that. And I thought it was a fascinating conversation because Sam just wanted to focus on the religion itself and didn't want to focus on economical reasons. And Dan was trying to communicate that to him, and he really stuck to his narrative, and that was the first time that I started questioning Sam, because I was right there with him the whole time, because, you know, I'm an atheist activist, so any religion is destructive to the world, in my opinion.
Right.
It wasn't a hard thing to sell when Sam or Bill would say things like Islam is the worst ideology in the world or something. Ooh, I'm paraphrasing, yeah. But something along those lines. And I thought, okay, yeah, that's fine. I mean, so one of them has to be the worst, and this one seems pretty bad, so no problem. But then once they start talking about, well, why are these things happening in the Middle East? Why do we have terrorism in the world? And they simply say, well, that's just the religion. The Quran's violent. I think that's where the conversation leaves me.
Yeah, you know, I guess what Sam is saying is that, you know, this has happened time and again with religion throughout history, and, you know, during the time of Jesus, and there was a lot of commotion and bloodshed and violence back then. And then you've had Christianity that kind of morphed into Christendom after Constantine. And then there was this kind of ideology and philosophy, you know, very expansionist, and a lot of wars and violence came out of that. And then you had the Crusades. And I guess from a Judeo-Christian perspective, that history has gone by and then people have reconciled with it. But now we've got a contemporary issue with Islam. And to some extent, you know, up to that part, I kind of can agree with him. But again, I think that core intellectualism is missing about, you know, what the core theology and the core events and the core foundation of the religion itself is. And for example, Sam himself pointed out that the Quran actually does not spell out any specific punishment for apostasy. It does not say to kill apostates. And this is a tradition, it's sort of a jurisprudent tradition that's come out of Islam, out of certain interpretations, and certain governments or certain dynasties in the past have entertained it, and mostly, I would say, for political purposes. But the Quran actually has a verse in there, which, you know, we use a lot, which basically it says La ikraha fid din, which means there is no compulsion in religion. You know, religion is a matter of the heart. It's a matter of your own evaluation, your intellectual disposition, and, you know, what is the effect of forcing religion onto somebody anyways? You know, it's, if you do that, it's not going to make them spiritual. It's not going to make them religious or close to God by any effect. You know, they're going to respond very negatively to that. So he's even brought that up. But, you know, for the most part, you're right. You know, it does come off as an attack on the religion itself.
I'm confused. I thought, and I don't know the Quran very well. I'll just preface with that. But I didn't expect you to say that the Quran doesn't say to kill infidels. I mean, it's full of that stuff. I don't know where to start with this. But I mean, whenever I talk to a Christian, for example, and I say, well, you know, there's a lot of violent stuff in the Old Testament. I mean, they immediately are like, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, I can explain it, but yeah, it's full of horrible things. You know, it was just that was the time, or, you know, you're taken out of context, or you have to understand that these people were different back then and God had to be hard on them or something like that. But to say that it doesn't say to kill infidels kind of shocks me, because I'm thinking, like, you would admit that there's a lot of violence and rape in the Quran. Like, that wouldn't be going too far to find common ground there, right?
Well, you know, I mean, there certainly is no rape in the Quran, but as far as violence, I wouldn't use the word violence, because I think that per se is sort of a derogatory term, and it implies the use of force to achieve maybe a political goal or a political ambition. But there are verses in the Quran, and the ones that Sam and even Christian apologists or whoever wants to oppose the Islamic religion and theology come up with a lot is in chapter 9, speaking to military engagement. You know, it's talking about fighting, it's talking about battles and wars. And the early Muslims, you know, once Muhammad started preaching Islam in Medina.
Fight until they pay jizya and feel subdued, something like that?
Jizya, right, the tax.
I'm going to mispronounce everything today.
Right.
I know you'll help me out.
Yeah, you know, and I'll quote one for you, which leads to that kind of that kind of thinking and those kind of questions, is that, you know, there's a 929 that says, you know, fight those from among the people of the book, and that's basically whenever the Quran references people of the book, it's Jews and Christians, who believe not in Allah nor in the last day, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is one verse in there, and a lot of people take that some foundation, and the fact is that people who commit acts of violence based on extremist ideologies do also source these kinds of texts.
Yeah.
But what is the reality behind it? I mean, you know, the key word there is context, and it's a broader historical study and evaluation. And I've written on the HuffPo about that as well. It's a longer discussion. But the key word here is that people of the book who do not believe in Allah nor in the last day. Now, I'll quote another verse, from the Quran as well, which is going to come off initially as maybe a blatant contradiction. And this is from chapter 2, verse 63. And it says, surely the believers, right? The believers and the Jews and the Christians and the Sabaeans and whoever believes in Allah and the last day, right? Which is the day of judgment. And does good deeds shall have their reward with their Lord. So the way I reconcile is that in the first verse where it says fight those people who don't believe in Allah or in the day of judgment, I think it's referring to those Jews and Christians who are not conforming to a sense of equity and a sense of justice, and they're opposing the Islamic movement unfairly. And that has to do with the context of the politics and the battles of the time. And in the second verse, because it says in the verse itself that these are the Jews and Christians who believe in God and who believe in the judgment and who believe in accountability. And they're the good guys, right? Whereas the other ones, no matter whatever social identity, they may call themselves Jews, they may call themselves Christians or even Muslims, or even those Muslims like ISIS calls themselves Muslims, right? But I can make a fair argument that they're not, or they're not following the Muslim teaching or the Muslim theology. That's kind of what we're up against. That's kind of what I'm up against as well, is that you'll have an act that's carried out, that's headlined across the world. It's going to drive a lot of emotion, a lot of reaction. And then people are going to quote a verse, cherry pick a verse. And they're going to say, well, here's the connection. Here's the association. Yeah,
I was planning on doing just that. If that...
Yeah. I'm trying to preempt you on that, I guess.
Fair enough.
That's the problem, right? That's the problem. And then we have to come back and say, look, there's such a broad context of the Roman war that was going on in Asia Minor and Arabia at the time that actually started pre-Constantine. Yeah, almost around the time when Constantine was there. And, I guess I can kind of get into that. I don't want to veer too much off subject. But, this was a war of religion. I recently read a great book by Peter Prankopen, who's the director of Byzantine Studies over at Oxford University, called The Silk Roads. And he's written three or four great chapters on this. And he basically calls it a war of religion between Rome and Persia. Constantine's conversion and his conviction and the birth of Christendom. Right. And there was populations of Eastern Christians living in Persia and Asia Minor at the time as well.
And yeah, I mean, it led to the Dark Ages. And it clearly that transition into Roman Catholicism and the destruction of the Republic, like that's what started the Dark Ages. Right. I mean, that was I agree with you. Religion had a really negative effect. But I also feel like. Like there's no way that you could say a holy war could be ethical, So I mean, even in terms of back to Islam, where you were saying, well, this is a political thing, so it's not necessarily saying we need to all just go kill infidels, but even if it's a political thing, that's still wrong too, right?
Well, I guess what are the core values behind it? If a religion such as let's say Constantine's Christianity. Or on the Persian side, it was basically Zoroastrianism, and both sides kind of really hardened as they clashed, as the empires themselves clashed. And historically, we know, like, for example, especially during Muhammad's time, at the time of the birth of Islam, Persia kind of got the upper hand, right? And they had a string of victories, and they actually ended up in Jerusalem. And they took down the Holy Cross from Jerusalem, and they carried it back to Persia. And the statements that were coming out was basically religious statements, is that, you know, Khusro, who was the chief of the Persians at the time, he was calling out Heraclius at the time, saying that, you know, if this is your God, this is your crucified God, you know, where's your position now? Where are you now? Look at this. They were forcing conversions, or they were actually enacting persecutions against the other side. And then what happens is that, you know, Rome comes back, grammatically comes back, and has a string of victories on the other side, and they actually get Jerusalem back. And Heraclius is making a number of statements on the other side. And now he enacts persecution against the Jews in Jerusalem. He ousts them from Jerusalem, even the Eastern Christians, because he believes they played a hand in Persia's victories. From both sides, it's a very hard attitude, and there is no room for freedom of expression, freedom of religion, freedom of conscience for both sides. Now, as the Islamic movement comes out and expands during this time and comes into conflict with Roman Persia, and I think that's kind of where some of this backdrop is coming from, and what these verses are speaking to, and what these foundational texts are speaking to. You know, the core principle in the Quran is that there can be no compulsion in religion. And Muhammad, he faced persecution initially in Mecca and had to migrate out of Mecca. There was an assassination attempt on his life as well. And he's invited to come and set up a government at Medina. You know, long story short, he comes up, and you know, Medina is a very multifarious society. It's got Jews, it's got polytheists, it's got heterodox Christians over there. And, you know, they're facing a bunch of complicated issues and political issues, and they're actually kind of going off at each other as well. You know, he comes from a polytheist society, so he's got sympathies on both sides. So he's somebody that they feel vested in, or feel confident that he'll come up with some kind of, you know, an amiable solution for everybody. So he comes up with a constitution, basically, with a set of agreements that we call it the Constitution of Medina. But in that is a basic value of the freedom of expression and the freedom of conscience. First of all, they came up with a whole set of agreements and accords between the different tribes, you know, in terms of coming together to defend the city if it's being attacked, things like that, military engagements.
I'm interested, and I hate to cut you off, but I fear that while that's fascinating, I worry that we kind of got off on a tangent.
Yeah.
Perhaps this explanation is necessary to explain what a holy war is, but it's. It seems like if I read something out of, let's say, Surah 2:191, I'm sure you were like, of course he goes there, but kill them wherever you catch them and turn them out from where they have turned you out, because persecution and injustice are worse than killing. Like passages like that, like I understand that you're saying this was a book that was written right after and during a war that was going on. Passages like that are violent passages. I don't feel like that's a long walk to take. I mean, that's a violent passage. And if I were to, let's say, I could rewrite the Quran and remove that passage and the passage that you spoke of, right? And I come out with one that just doesn't have that. It has everything else. It has all the good stuff, because there is a lot of good stuff and a lot of fascinating scientific things in there, right? And it's got all that. But if I just took out the violent stuff, wouldn't it be a better book?
Well, I mean, you know, you're the thing is, what do you think? There are going to be situations where there is going to be a war and there is going to be a battle against people who persecute, who do not allow for freedom to exist or for freedom to flourish. And they only want things on your terms. So let me take, for example, Nazi Germany, you know, which didn't happen too long ago. And when we meet them, there is going to be death and destruction and there is going to be violence. But it's justified. And this is how it's justified. And these are the the commonly understood moral values, time-honored values that we're basing this on, I don't think that's a disagreeable context. And I understand that we got off on a tangent over there, and you know, maybe this is not the time to pull in all the history that I feel that we need to look at that. But we do have to look at it in terms of the context of what was happening at the time and what was going on and the persecution. And, you know, the people that the Quran is asking you to fight are the people who wanted to destroy the Islamic movement just on the basis of their beliefs.
But it refers to them as pagans.
Are you referring to some verse over here now?
For example, 9:5, right? It says, kill the pagans wherever you find them, right? And I don't, you say that perhaps I'm taking it out of context, but I don't know a context that kill the pagans wherever you find them would be appropriate. And if it's referring to a simple war, like where you were comparing, you know, Nazi Germany, why would they be referred to as pagans? Pagans is someone that doesn't believe what you believe. That's a holy war. That's unethical. That's wrong. And if I took that passage out of the Quran, I have immediately improved your book. If I can do that, then that means that I can write a better book than Allah, which seems kind of impractical if it's God, right?
Again, you know, we can't just cherry pick a few words or even just one particular verse, you know, without looking into the overall context. And sometimes that exists right there. So if you go to the very next one, you know, it says that, and if anyone of the idolaters or the pagans ask for your protection, you know, grant them that protection. And, you know, convey them over to a place of security.
Looking at, 9:6, if they ask for a place of safety, give it to them. And that's cool, but do they have to accept the religion to have that?
No, absolutely not. Because there's a verse in the Quran, and we have to reconcile to that verse that there can be no compulsion in religion. And we know that was not the case. We know that was not the case, that they would be asked to convert. So freedom of religion was a core and fundamental aspect of the early Islamic development. And actually, Peter Frankopan in the Silk Roads attests to that. And using non-Islamic texts, historical texts, referring to basically the building of churches. And this is after these initial battles took place that the Quran is referring to. This is during an expansionist phase that came later, where the Roman and the Persian empires were actually brought down, and you know, Muslim conquest basically overtook that. And you know, in a famous incident, for example, the Caliph Omar, he conquers Jerusalem, and he ends the persecution. Famously, this is a famous incident historically, where Jews are permitted to now re-enter Jerusalem. I mean, you know, what I'm saying is that if you pull that those specific words and that verse, like I was saying, that this tends to happen a lot in the media narrative, and it does get amplified exponentially in the backdrop of, let's say, a specific act of terrorism. But intellectually,
if one of the pagans asks you for a place of safety, give it to him so that he may hear the word of Allah. That's forced evangelism. That's still wrong. I appreciate where you're saying, yeah, I mean, it says kill them where you find them. And it's almost like we just move past that. Like, that's okay. And then, but we move and you're like, yeah, but it says give them a place of safety if they ask for it. Right. But that's so that they hear the word of Allah. Right. And it later says, because they're men without knowledge. So in other words, they're pagans. They don't have our religion. Give them safety so that you can religionize them. That's still wrong. That's still forcing a religion on them. So I get that you can read it. And this happens with the Christian Bible a lot, too, where we'll say, well, you can read it in a really good way. But I'm saying, yeah, but you can read that in a really bad way. I could totally justify if I were to replace Islam in this passage, right? If we're not talking about Islam at all, we're just talking about Scientology, right? Or you know what? Let's do something that's kind of even funnier than that. What are the people that like live on farms and stuff and have horses?
Amish.
Yeah. Okay. So if the Amish were coming after people with pitchforks, right? And they said, well, hold on, our Bible, our God tells us, kill the pagan where you find them. So kill non-Amish people where you find them. and you go, well, hold on, that's wrong. Your God's immoral. And they say, yeah, well, if you want safety, we'll give you safety so that you can hear the word of the Amish Allah. You know what I mean? Like, that wouldn't justify it. You would still be like, Amish people are very violent. Like, and even if you came across a very polite and respectable, peaceful Muslim like yourself, you know, but if you came across a peaceful and respectable Amish guy and he said, well, we don't mean it that way. We mean it in a much nicer way. I think your natural response would go, yeah, but it could be taken both ways. And therefore, it is an immoral doctrine. Is that fair that you would admit that it could be taken both ways?
No, I don't think it can, because it's speaking to a specific wartime context, you know, where there is a specific engagement for a certain reason. You know, if one party persecutes the other and says, well, you're not allowed to exist because of your beliefs, then they're the one who are in the wrong. And, you know, in this situation where, you know, the enemy, or, you know, engage with the enemy or fight the enemy, you're fighting them in that specific context. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, you know, you should still be, have the higher ground enough to be overly cruel in that situation. And if somebody is in a weak position, you know, give them safety, give them some security. And, let them hear about, you know, what the true values of justice and peace should be, and how peace should exist. And that's, I'd say that agrees with the historical context that I'm talking about. But what ISIS is doing is completely antithetical to the historical development from that time.
I see.
But, you know, what you're alluding to is, yes, that's the problem. That's what we're up against in a sort of a media narrative.
We'll get back to Amir Aziz here momentarily, right after this break, and discuss his take on the Quran's endorsement of rape.
Learn more about the broadcast at therighttoreason.com. Follow us on Twitter at RightToReason1. Like our page on Facebook. Subscribe to us on YouTube. Support the Right to Reason at patreon.com/right.
You had mentioned there was no rape in the Quran, and I thought maybe I misspoke with saying, like, there's acts of rape. And the wife just bought the Quran for me recently, so I've been reading it. I haven't completed it yet, so that's why I appeal to your knowledge on it. But what I do come across a lot is, it seems fairly clear to me, honestly, the endorsement of rape. I haven't come across a spot where it's actually, like, telling a story of rape, like I could find throughout much of the Old Testament, for example, or something. But it keeps using this term, and maybe you can help me understand it. Whatever your right hand possesses, or whom your right hand possesses. And each time I read that, it seems to be in a context where it's talking about a woman and owning her, as if, like, you beat up, you destroyed this other city, and then you get to collect all their women, and your right hand possesses this woman, and now she's like your sex slave, is the way that I'm understanding it. Is that close? Okay.
But yeah, that's how a lot of people, tend to think of it, or sometimes that's how they push it. But basically, again, you know, going back to the details and the context of the time, what that is referring to, people possessed by the right hand, is that when you had these military engagements back then, and, you know, you'd have a tribe fight another one, or you'd have a city fight another one, and there'd be a certain number of deaths, and there'd be prisoners of war, right? Only that in that time and place, we didn't have a prison system the way we have today. So you would have all these widows, you know, in a situation where one tribe, let's say, for example, takes over another one. And the question would be, well, how do we deal with the situation? How do we handle it? How do we integrate it? Or how do we secure it where you have a lot of people and families and widows left over from a war or from a battle. And what the idea and the structure that they came up with was to assign these people into Muslim households who would then be responsible for their welfare.
You're saying he's taking care of them?
They're kind of taking care of them, but at the same time, they're also trying to figure out how to assimilate them into society or what the best options for these people are, you know, without burdening.
Not having sex with them.
No, not at all. That's not what it's talking about. It's not talking about sex slavery or hedonism or, you know, taking over a people, beating them in battle and then, you know, having fun with their widows. You know, what this is about seriously dealing with a situation like that, you know, where you would be coming out of a battle and you'd have a large number of widows left over, and how to integrate them and assimilate them into your existing structure, society, or your tribe. And this is a time where there were no prisons, you know, and no structures or processes like that at the time. So the idea that they came up with was to assign these women to certain Muslim households who would then be responsible for their safekeeping, caretaking on a day-to-day basis while they worked on re-assimilating them into society or working out some acceptable option for these people.
I think he is talking about sex, though. I totally get, okay, I'm a novice with this, and you are well-versed with this sort of thing, appropriately saying well-versed, right? But, well, just Surah 23, right from the beginning, successful indeed, must be the believers, those who make themselves humble in their prayer, and those who avoid useless talk, and those who give charity, and those who guard their chastity, which it sounds like exactly what you're saying right there, right? Guard your chastity, not being rapey, you know, that sounds good. He says, except with those, and this is 23:6, except with those united to them by the bond of marriage or whom their right hand possesses. For them, they are free from blame. Okay, so he's talking about chastity, and he says, except for people that you're married to, and here's that word again. And every time I see it, I kind of cringe. Your right hand possesses. It's like this, I get what you're saying, that what that really means is that you're taking care of someone and helping them, but that sounds like sex to me. Am I misunderstanding that?
Well, again, this is this 23:25 that you're referring to?
Yes, sir. 23:25 and 26. I didn't want to take it out of context, so that why I tried to read the whole thing from 23:1 to 23:6, but that's where I stopped. But honestly, that does sound like sex, dude.
Again, we do need to reconcile that with other verses, and I'll share, you know, a few over here with you. So this one is 24:33, which says that, you know, marry widows from among you and from among your male slaves and female slaves. So it's actually ask who are fit for marriage. So it's actually, asking for, you know, a marriage to take place, you know, among the slaves.
That one sounds worse than mine. 24:33. Hold on. Oh, it's a big verse. It says, get them from the slaves around you. But you're saying it says ass. It says, do not force your maids to prostitution. That sounds good. Shouldn't do that. Ask for a note in writing. Give them such a note if you know any good from them. Help me understand this. What are you asking a note for?
The one that says, and marry widows from among you and your male slaves and female slaves. Do you have that as 24:32?
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
okay.
Yes.
All right, I'm with
Sorry,
you. 24:32.
So that's the
marry those among you who are single, and the virtuous ones among your slaves, male servants and maid servants. If they are in poverty, Allah will provide them ways out of his grace, and Allah understands all needs. He knows all things.
Great. So it's asking you to marry them. And there's other verses as well, which have the same thing, which says that, you know, you need to marry your slaves. So it's
isn't that bad? Having slaves at all, but especially marrying a slave, wouldn't that be bad, though?
Oh, I think isn't sex slavery worse? It's definitely not that, right? I mean, marriage
brings
you into a far more sanctified and dignified position, and you have inheritance rights, you have...
Slavery is wrong, right? I mean, you and I'm sure we can agree on that.
Yeah, slavery is wrong, and...
Would you admit that there is no context in which slavery is moral whatsoever?
Well, there's a much wider discussion on that in terms of how Islam, how it eradicated slavery.
So you're saying that there is a context where slavery is moral?
As a broader context, which...
I'm not trying to trick you in anything. I'm confused that it either is or it isn't. Like, I don't think I'm being naive if I say there is no time that it's okay to have a slave, ever. No matter what situation I'm in, it's just wrong. It's a wrong thing to do, to own people. I don't think I'm being, like, misunderstanding some facet of history or of religious doctrine. It's okay to make that statement. It seems pretty obvious.
Right, and
especially not marry your slave. That's sex slavery. That's what that is.
Well, I mean, if you're coming out of a wartime, sort of a battle situation, and you're taking people in, and there's going to have to be certain rules.
Make them good rules? Why not make them ethical rules? Like, you know.
Well, you know, only a while back they were enemy combatants. You know, you can't let them loose into the streets right away under laws which are basically geared and engineered to deal with that society in a normal situation.
Are you saying
in a more normal state of affairs? But the Quran does not sanction slavery. It's basically what it's saying is that it is, you're going to have to go through that. And, you know, as far if you do the proper analysis and then the history on Islam, it was instrumental in eradicating slavery. In fact, Muhammad himself elevated slaves to positions of government, positions of religious leadership, government leadership. There's the case of Salman Farsi, who became governor of the district of Medellin. But, you know, I
don't know that we're going to find common ground on this topic, but
you know, look at those verses too, which talk about, you know, like there's a verse in the Quran that says, you know, what is the high ground? You know, the high ground is basically freeing a slave, you know, free your slaves.
We could agree there, I guess. Yeah. I know you're a busy guy as editor and writer, and I feel bad about keeping you as long as I did, but I really appreciate your time. But how can people find your writing and learn more about you?
Amer-azizi.weebly. That's weebly.com. And it's got all my writings and references over there. And if you want to learn more about Ahmadiyya, you know, which we believe is the current prophetic dispensation by God, by his messenger, the second coming of Christ, Mirza Ghulam Ahmad, you can go to www.alislam, that's A-L-I-S-L-A-M, which means the Islam, alislam.org.
Amir was a lot of fun, very fascinating guy. He really has a firm grasp of history. This conversation doesn't end, actually. It continued on, and if any of you are religious study nerds like myself, you'll enjoy hearing the rest of that discussion at the end of this show. It wasn't part of the debate, so I thought I'd leave it separate, but it's really interesting, so I couldn't leave it out of the production. So after my closing today, just stay with us and you'll hear that part of the conversation. Speaking of the production, I want to thank our contributors to today's broadcast. As always, Jason Camo from A Lost State of Mind, and welcoming a new voice and sound of the show, David Blair. You can get a free download of his music at davefreesong.com/freemusic. I'll include both those links in the show notes, as well as Amir Aziz's previously mentioned links. I also want to thank our patrons that made this episode possible, My Humble Assault, Anima Man, Phil Calderon, and Larry Wilson. Thank all of you very much. If you want to become a Patreon supporter as well, you can do so at patreon.com/right. Next week, we'll be talking about money with Michael Schaefer of the Reasonable Risk Podcast. Very cool guy and super wise when it comes to finance from a skeptical perspective. That's next week. Between now and then, remember that you have the right to reason. I was hoping I could find out one more thing before you go. I don't know if this is the right characterization, but you're not the typical Muslim that I think a lot of people think of. Like, you had, like, a lot of people think, like, Muslims, they got their prophet Muhammad, and they got Allah as their God. That's kind of what we know about them, you know? But you actually have a Messiah that already came. Is that a correct understanding?
Yes, correct.
And that's fascinating to me. Like, I love stuff like this. Like, can you explain that a little bit for
us? Yeah, and I'll make it a little bit more fascinating as well. In fact, maybe exponentially fascinating. That Messiah that we believe in, we believe him to be the second coming of Jesus. So, you know, he is Mirza Ghulam Ahmed, who lived in India in a place called Qadian, India, from 1835 to 1908. So of course, we don't believe in the second coming of Christ as in a literal sense. We take it to be allegorical or symbolic. And we say that it's happened in pretty much the same way that it happened before during Jesus' time, when, you know, he was questioned, when Jesus was questioned by the Jews that, you know, hey, if you're the Messiah, if you're the promised Messiah, then where's Elijah? You know, the harbinger who was supposed to come down from the heavens in chariots of fire and announce the coming of the Messiah. And Jesus explained that John the Baptist, you know, is the second coming of Elijah. That's basically, yeah. That's...
I always thought that was a little weird.
It's symbolic, yeah. You know, it's basically Elijah was a great prophet of God, you know, very spiritual guy, and he brought people close to God, and that's what John the Baptist does as well. So that's what that means, and that's the only precedent we have. And so we say that that's fundamental, that's instrumental. And kind of prophetic thought, end times thinking, or what we also call eschatology, probably the greatest common denominator in terms of prophecy is the second coming of Jesus, which I don't know if you're familiar with that. It's a common belief among Muslims, among Orthodox Muslims. In fact, all Muslims, I would say, that it's...
Is that Jesus didn't come back a second time yet, or that he did?
He will.
And you guys believe that as well?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. No, that's very cool.
It's a key belief to be a Muslim. Is that they believe that
So that's something Muslims and Christians have in common. They both believe that Jesus will come back.
That's the part they have in common. However, that's where they diverge. You know, he's going to come back, and obviously both sides think that they're going to take, he's going to take their side and overcome the other or fight the other.
Do you think Jesus was a Muslim then?
Well, I think he was a Muslim in the sense that a Muslim means one who is submitted to God, who is submitted to Islam, and you know, the values therein. So you can say that he was a Muslim in the sense, as in he was a great prophet of the God. But of course, there was no social identity as a Muslim at the time.
Yeah.
So he wasn't.
But still, I'd love to see you like a Christian and like you guys arguing back and forth, and you'd be like, hey, Jesus was a Muslim too, and just watch them just like boil over.
Well, and here's a little bit that I would like to tack on. You know, when we say that, you know, we believe in the second coming of Jesus in a symbolic sense, you know, then we get asked, well, how, right? Can you elaborate a little bit on that and tell us how can Mirza Ghulam Ahmed be the second coming of Jesus? Basically, Jewish and Islamic dispensations both kind of started off with great empires, right? In the following of Moses, we had Joshua, who had a lot of, you know, had to fight a lot of wars and battles against his enemies. Same thing kind of happened in Muhammad's following. And by the time we get to David and Solomon, we have this great Jewish empire, a great civilization at the time. And from there on, we basically get a downfall. And, you know, it keeps getting worse and worse. And then you have the first temple that's destroyed by the Babylonians. By the time Jesus comes along, the Jews are in a very anguished and grievous state, you could say, right? I mean, they're being ruled by what they see as an idolatrous, pagan Roman Empire. And, you know, they see corruption in the temple with the high priests. And they're thinking, well, what went wrong? You know, what did we do wrong? Why are we in this position? We were God's chosen people, and we were doing so well. A lot of them feel that, you know, they need to go back and kind of do what Joshua did, right? But they have a very wrong interpretation of it. And, you know, they see the Jews as Hellenized, as being kind of overtaken or highly influenced by Roman culture. And in their ideology, if you read what the Zealots did during the time, and there was groups like the Sicarii, you know, the dagger-wielding throat slitters, they would basically kill Jews, you know, who they thought were not not real Jews, that they had apostated because they had, given up the true Judaic lifestyle and the values. And there was all this terrorism that spawned during the time. And Jesus' message was that, you know, that context, that you're, you know, you've completely lost that context that happened in the following of Moses and Joshua. You got to live under Caesar. Well, you know, that's your position in this day and age. But give to God, that's the famous, I don't have the exact reference in front of me, but that's the verse from the Bible, you know, when he's approached by the Pharisees that, about that.
That statement alone, like, changed the world.
Yeah, right.
More than any other statement to me. Give unto Caesar that which is Caesar. I feel like that, and I mean, this doesn't have historical evidence to it, but just if looking at the entirety of Roman Republic, Roman Empire, and just how it progressed, you know, after Constantine, which you were referencing earlier, that one statement, I feel like, gave Christians a special ability to work with their government, to be submissive to their government. That allowed Caesar and every emperor thereafter to go, well, these guys are hip to us. Right, let's use them. We can still profit from them. And that's why we have the three dominant religions that we have today. That gave Judaism a special advantage, you know, as well, because Jesus was a Jew. And now we've got, I think, in my opinion, as looking at it as a secularist, right, that's why we have Islam, Judaism, and Christianity today as the three dominant religions of the world, because of that one statement.
Yeah, but they didn't agree with him at the time. The Jews did not. Definitely the temple priesthood did not agree with him. I mean, they really felt that Rome has their interpretations of eschatology at the time, because they believed they were living in the end times as well, and they thought the Messiah is going to come, and the Messiah is actually going to conquer Rome, and it's actually going to conquer over the whole world for them. And then everybody's going to believe in the one true God, maybe become a Jew. And, you know, that's the happy ending that they were looking for. But it didn't exactly turn out that way. Submission, or let's say being a good citizen to your government, is an act of faith. And you can still be religious and spiritual and, you know, worship God the way you want to and live your life the way you want to. And, you know, in fact, the fanaticism and the violence during Jesus' time, the religious extremism, got so bad that, Josephus, Flavius Josephus, you may have heard of him, he's a famous Jewish historian at the time. He calls it the fourth philosophy. And he says, this is something new and very different that's going on here. And there are these people who believe that we've got to violently just mow down anybody that we think is an apostate from Judaism, be it a Jew that's trying to be a Greek or a Roman, or it's the Greeks and the Romans, the Gentiles and the Romans themselves. And he calls it the fourth philosophy. And he actually talks about it as well, you know, a reign of terror. Now, fast forward, what I'm trying to get to as to how does this symbolize the second coming of Jesus is that in Islam, you know, with the context of the Roman-Persian wars that I gave and the conquest over the Romans and the Persians by the early Muslims, we believe that there is a true moral context over there, and that there were people who believed in the freedom of conscience and the freedom of religion. But now, fast forward, the Muslim communities Muslim societies last 200 years or so have been living under colonial rule over an extended period of time, and there's been these grievances that have been building up exactly pretty much the same way as how it happened with the Zealots, that, you know, what have we done wrong? Where did we go wrong? And what do we got to do to get out of this rut? You know, we're overpowered and influenced and culturally influenced and in a number of ways, and we hardly have any say in anything anymore, and we can't control our own people and our old governments, and our leaders are corrupt, and there's this anguish that gets bottled up. And then it's unleashed in the most violent way. And I think ISIS, you'd be very surprised, their beheadings, their beheading videos. In fact, I wrote an article about this as well. And they wield these daggers, these throat-slitting daggers, those black jumpsuits and stuff. And it's very similar to a group called the Sicarii during Jesus' time, who basically did the same thing. You know, they just went around and they just wanted to create a very grisly, violent effect by slitting people's throats.
Fascinating. So it's like thousands of years later, it's a reemergence of this old tactic.
Right, it's a reenactment and the second coming of Christ. So Mirza Ghulam Ahmad basically said the same things what Jesus said. So they had similar notions, about being under the rule of a foreign government that has the false teachings or has the wrong teachings, and that they need to go out and basically force this religion. And of course, vastly, you know, really grossly misinterpreting the original context of Muhammad's time and why he had to fight those wars and why he had to fight those battles. These guys had just gone off on way off on an aberration, you know, killing apostates and blasphemers and things like that. And it's just a royal mess, exactly how it was during Jesus' time. And you know how Rome responded to that eventually when the war broke out with the Zealots.
Hey, thanks, man. I appreciate it. Do you feel comfortable going again sometime? Maybe I hit you up in a couple months.
Yeah, definitely. You know, we can go over a couple of more interesting topics.
I'd love to talk more about things that you write about in HuffPo too. I wanted to spend more time on that. I thought we'd spend more on that and less on the Quran. And I really didn't expect to get to the Quran because I knew I didn't know it. So every time I'd be like, I want to talk about this verse, but I'm also like, Robert, don't do it. You know, but I do want to talk about this stuff. Like, it is like,
you knew quite a bit of it, and you knew those passages do get thrown around and they get circulated. So I'm not too surprised.
What I feel like, I have been reading it. I really have been trying to get it. I love religion. You know, I hate religion, from an activist sense, but I love studying it. You know, I think that there are certain narrative truths from Islam and Christianity and Judaism and Zoroastrianism and all this Buddhism. Obviously, I think Buddhism's got a lot of stuff in it. But it's just, I think that there's truths there, but I think that the way that they're trying to propagate these truths, they have to use myth to do it.
Maybe if you want to, you know, in some future session, we can take up is there really a God behind this? You know,
that's what we were supposed to talk about.
Let's do that.
Okay. Yeah. On the next one, let's just focus. Okay. You'll have to keep me from doing it. Whenever I go to the Quran, you have to be like, Robert, stop.
Yeah. I prefer not to get into that, you know, minutiae and kind of just get bogged down into a verse or two. Or even though it's important, and I think the stuff that you brought up is important because it's out there. And people are talking about it.
It's pretty obvious to me.
And they're going to say, whoa, wait, what's this, you know? So we got to do that as well, I understand. But I think let's...
Okay, a couple months, I'm going to hit you up, and we're just going to do theology.
Yeah.
Thanks, man. I really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, man.